Welcome to episode 267 of After the Credits, your Littlest Hobo Media Spew for July. Oh, that's much better. I am your co-host, Marine Antunes, joined today by fellow co-hosts.
Colleen, I got nothing.
Dale from ATC Pod.
Hooray!
Hooray! So we're going to talk about some stuff that we've been watching and listening to and reading and whatever else.
General media spewage.
Our general thing. Yeah. Just our ramblings about things we've been watching and stuff.
And maybe some specific things.
Ooh, maybe. Maybe.
Who wants to start and with what?
I started last time. Colleen can start. All right.
TV, Netflix, Crave-esque things.
Let's do it.
All my lists are really short, so...
Yeah, I don't have as much as I usually do, but I still have a few.
But Mike Tyson Mystery, like season four
What?
Mike Tyson Mysteries.
I'm sorry.
Oh, these are awesome. They're 15-minute. Like, there's like four seasons of them now. 15 minutes. It's animated with Mike Tyson and his daughter, I guess, a ghost of the Lord of...
What the fuck?
Oh, my God. And a pigeon that basically was cursed.
I've never heard of this.
Oh, it is crazy. And they have pigeons that come to their coop, and like people have asked them, "Dear Mike Tyson Mysteries, I have this problem," and they'll go solve it. Oh, my God. It is bizarre.
What is this on?
Wow. And this is Netflix. It is one of the... this is right up there with like Drunk History. It's so fucked up.
I admit to seeing that thing flash by as, you know, you're lost in Netflix land, but I just didn't even imagine.
Super short, super weird. So the new ones are out, and they're just enjoyable. And sometimes the best parts of it are after the credits roll. They have Mike Tyson. They've done interviews, and he's just talking about the weirdest ass shit. Like, they'll ask him questions, and he's like...
Off over here.
Serious head damage on that dude. Holy shit. Sometimes it's the best part of the entire show. Super rude, super fucked up, super everything I want from a Mike Tyson animated mystery.
Great.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I have just burned through six seasons of the series Glee.
I'm sorry. Why?
Okay. I didn't watch every episode, but someone like, I don't know if I watched eat more than like a couple seconds of Glee while it was on.
Like, to me, this is like you watching Friends or Melrose Place. Well, it just seems so
odd. Obsession with Pitch Perfect. It's like, why? This makes no sense. But someone pointed out that there's this character called Becky.
Yes.
Or Becca.
Yes.
And she's a Down syndrome lady and is playing a high school student. And I just sat down and watched one episode, fast forward, found her kind of thing, and she's like, "I'm so dumb with you basic bitches," and like just super mean and cruel, and I'm like going, oh my God, I love this character. So I IMDb and found every episode she was in,
so you'll, okay.
And I only watched those episodes because she's awesome. This is like literally the best part of that entire series.
You could do a supercut.
Supercut, yeah. Like it probably
supercut.
Probably work out to be like about 3 hours worth of like the show because they're small little parts. Her obsession with throwing xylophones on the ground out of rage. I'm like, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. I loved it. So that's basically the only things I've watched. Otherwise, I've been doing home repairs.
That's a thing.
Yeah.
Dale?
TV.
TV.
Jet, I am liking it. It is dark as fuck.
It's still on my to-watch list.
Wow. Like in the last episode, someone was hacked up with a chainsaw.
Love it. I'm in.
And Carla Giacconi's, I hope I'm saying her.
Cugino.
Wow. I wasn't even close. Carla Cugino. Who's also got an executive producer credit. Her character is... this woman, like, I would put her up for playing the next Bond.
Oh, she's great. She elevates everything she's in. She just happens to be in a lot of really mediocre movies. But she's always, always good.
This one is I think, on the edge. It's certainly edgier than a lot of the stuff in terms of it does not pull any punches.
It's a Showtime series, right? Or is it like Cinemax?
Oh, I think Cinemax.
I think it's Cinemax. Cinemax. Yeah, Cinemax is really kind of on the outskirts. They do some really, really good stuff.
So I don't think it would be for everyone. Also, I'm like really trying to, it's, I think, a male producer, ultimately, like just trying to like, if this was directed by a woman, how would it be?
Yeah,
like doing that whole thing? And I'm like the last person to be able to judge that. But I don't know. From that perspective, I have no idea. But I am enjoying it. It is dark as hell. It does not, like, I was flinching in a couple places. Oh, man, like the chains. I don't know, like that whole, but yeah, if that sounds at all like interesting, I would check it out for sure. Killjoys is back. I still haven't watched any of the episodes yet, but they're calling it the final season. So hopefully it ends it right.
I have to say, we've seen like the commercials for the new series, the new season. And I'm like, cause I think I've seen like three or four episodes of that show and I never really got into it. And every time I watch like something about the new season, I'm like, but that sounds so cool. I should be watching this show, but I just can't get into it. I don't know why.
This is, I'm really curious to know now whether they actually started out with a overall show arc. Every season has been different from the last one.
That's the sense I get.
Changed the story up. In a couple seasons, like significantly changed the story up. Mm-hmm. So I've enjoyed it so far. There was, like with most shows, some seasons are a little weaker than others, but I hope they end it well. The Rook, I'm really enjoying The Rook.
Okay, so you have to tell me because this is,
I saw it advertised on a bus in Vancouver.
So this was the thing. I know that they're now like on season 2, maybe 3. And I know that it's, I think, a Hulu show, right? I at some point I remember seeing some trailers for it. And I thought, oh, this looks really interesting. I added it to my watch list. I still haven't gotten around to it. And then randomly the other day, I'm like, why the fuck are they advertising The Rook on a bus?
This is a British series. It's only got like 7 or 8 episodes, I think. As far as I know, there's only the one season.
Oh, okay.
And I'm trying to, it's, I think it's Showtime, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
It's progressing along nicely. It has all those elements I like. Like there's a mystery unfolding.
Okay.
The characters are good. There's some interesting characters. So yeah, thumbs up to that. The In-Between is continuing to be fun, even though it's like one of my cheesy procedurals.
Mm.
And as is Elementary. Although, yes. You know, I think there was an interesting discussion. There was an article that just came out that judged all of the Sherlock Holmes things. And I don't think it put Elementary in its proper place, really.
I don't think people give that show enough credit.
And it's on its 7th season. Mm-hmm. So obviously they're doing something right.
I just can't get over the fact that it's Sherlock and Watson. Like, if it was, they had picked any other names and ran with something that was vaguely sort of the same idea, but he's not Sherlock Holmes. She's not Watson. It just, no matter how you spin it in my mind, it tears me out of it so badly. Yeah, I don't know.
You're a unique snowflake.
I know.
But the thing is, I don't think Colleen is alone. I think that there are Sherlock Holmes fans that probably fall in the same category.
You're not a unique snowflake. How does that make you feel?
I should be what everyone basically strives for. I should be the typical. Damn it. The fact that I'm not is annoying.
I feel that way sometimes too. It's like, why can't everyone see it my way? Because this sucks.
Why can't everyone just never phone anyone ever again and have everything done basically through texting or online?
I'm okay with that.
I'd mostly go with that, except when I'm in the car, because I can actually call hands-free.
Yeah.
But
it's hard to text or whatever else.
And the last show I'm going to mention, I've watched one episode of it. It's called Pandora. It is, I watched it because it's a sci-fi. It's done along the same lines as The Outpost. Like, just barely marginally adequate CG.
Okay.
It feels like it is like the outpost in space. Like literally the character.
Does it have anything to do with the movie? Oh, fuck. The movie who's I'm off today with names. The one that James Cameron directed.
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Avatar?
Yeah.
No.
Because that takes place on Pandora, and my first thought was, these things related?
Only in the sense that they're loosely riffing off the Greek. Okay. The main character is like Pandora, and there's like a Pandora's box kind of. It is just actually, after watching the first episode, so derivatively bad. Oh.
Hey man, the 100 started terribly, and look where where we ended up.
It's still terrible, cannot look away.
It is not terrible.
That actually, I'm about four episodes behind.
That is all
my TV.
I don't have a lot either. However, I have a story. So
tell
Veronica
story.
Mars,
oh yeah,
dropped a week early. Dropped at the end of Comic-Con. You know, Kristen Bell came out and said, "Congratulations, Marshmallows, you get your show a week in advance." And I'm like, how the fuck am I going to get to watch this a week in advance? Thank you, Crave, and your free 1 month subscription. Signed up for my 1 month subscription of Crave.
Oh, is it the Crave Plus movie, or is this on normal Crave?
It's just on normal Crave.
Wow, I can see it then.
I mainlined season 4 of Veronica Mars in 4 days, and that is maybe stretching it out longer than I probably, you know, I could have watched this in one sitting, but I'm like, I must enjoy this. And I took it in 4 days, and it's so good, people. It's so good. It's one of the revivals that really, 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 really works.
Nice.
It's so great.
Nice.
Very, very good. So I don't think Veronica Mars fans will be disappointed. It's really sad. It's really good. It's very biting. It's great.
Excellent.
And now because I have Crave for a month, I've been trying to mainline all the shit that is on Crave that I've wanted to see. So the next thing I watched was, I have to look at it because I can't remember the name of it, Escape at Dannemora, which is a Showtime series. It's a limited series. The whole thing was directed by Ben Stiller, which I know, a bit weird. However, it is so good. Huh. So it's based on the real life story of David Sweat and Richard Matt, who were convicts at Clinton Correctional Facility in upstate New York, and they escaped. And they were on the run for, I think it was like 20 days. And so the show opens with the interrogation of a woman who worked at the prison in the tailor shop, and her involvement. It starts kind of like, well, how did you know the two inmates? And that's sort of how the story is told in like in flashback. It is so, so good. It stars Paul Dano and Benicio del Toro.
What?
Yes, and Patricia Arquette, who is fucking brilliant. They're all nominated for Emmys. If they don't all win, they got robbed because they're amazing. The show is so good. It's 7 hours. There's 7 episodes. They're all about an hour long. The first one, I think, is the longest. It's like 1 hour and 3 minutes. Brilliant.
Oh, I thought they might do like 20 episodes. Each day is a new episode.
No, but it's really, really good.
Cool.
Really, really good.
You had
good.
Me at Benicio
del Toro.
Thank you.
And he plays creepy really, really well.
He always has.
Yeah. He does.
Yeah. I also watched, Dan and I watched season 3 of Stranger Things. Did you guys watch this yet?
I have not yet.
I got as far as episode 2. It's still in my watching.
So it's really great. Better than season 1.
Season 1?
Than season 2. Okay. Not as good as season 1.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm jumping around. Still really solid. They kind of split up the characters, which is kind of interesting. So they each have... Not each, but like they've kind of segregated them into little groups, and they spend quite a few of the episodes apart from each other.
So what actually happens in Friends when they grow up? They go separate little cliques?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Pretty much. There is, I guess maybe I won't say it. The final episode has a moment that I was not expecting that made me smile so hard I had to rewind and watch it like 3 times. and it is related to the Neverending Story. I will leave it there.
All right.
And I think that's it. That's all I watch for TV.
All right.
Wow.
Dale was talking and mentioned James Bond, and I have to say, just on a side note, that the fact that the next 007 is female.
Yep.
Not James Winning. Bond, but got the code name 007.
Winning.
You know what?
And all the social justice warrior sort of fanboys screaming and pulling out their hair. Good on you.
Yeah.
Well, it's not the SJWs. It's
where I know, but like complaining about.
I thought that that move was brilliant. You know, because James Bond is such an artifact of the 60s.
Yeah.
In its whole inception, but the concept is so cool. So to like, I don't know who thought of it.
Yeah.
But
not James Bond.
Keeping the number.
Yeah.
And you know, the contact or the setting. But
yeah.
I'm looking forward to our new era.
Agreed.
Damn right.
Because they were like making themselves into pretzels, trying to make Bond relevant in the new millennium. And it just was.
Although that said, I still think, was it Elbrus?
Idris Elba?
Yeah,
Idris
Elba would make a freaking really kick-ass Bond. James Bond.
I agree.
Wow.
I agree.
I think he would. I mean, he's just such a great actor. He wouldn't quite be my first choice for Bond, but I would have no complaints if they chose him.
The thing is, through like a lot of the world, Whitey James Bond isn't going to cut it. Like I'm sure MI6 has like a rainbow of like people. So why?
Pretty sure known for anyway. That's a different discussion.
Yeah, you know what? They assimilate a lot of cultures and enforce their English way, like a colonization. But there's a lot of multicultural, whether they like it or not. So MI6 is going to use.
Have you seen how fucked up their government is? Oh, like this whole Brexit thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
I don't know. That's institutional.
I will comment on that.
Well, just look at the U.S. kind of thing. I think the intelligence organizations are still functioning, although they're ripping out their hair at their administration. I suspect that like the actual intelligent parts of like the British Secret Service and things like that are shaking their heads, going, "Why are you making this so difficult for us?" And carrying on.
I respectfully.
I could
Valerie Plume, her story. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. That's just the impression I get. But
I wish it were that way.
Yeah.
One can hope.
Yeah.
Movies.
None. Pass.
Okay, I only saw four. Most they were all done before the last millennium, but not millennium. Yeah. Tokyo Joe 1949, Humphrey Bogart.
Ooh.
What a weird blend of like machismo and toxic masculinity.
Oh,
he plays an anti-hero. I don't know. I almost feel like I'm going to spoil it because I know people haven't seen it, but
they should because it's Bogart.
It is like that old style of Hollywood where they actually aren't afraid to kill characters, and this
love
was,
it.
Man, for gender study, there would be so much material in here. I just didn't know what to think of this. I honestly did not know what I was like going, what the fuck, so many times on this. I don't know that I can recommend it. I can only say that it, like, if you just want like a kind of a blast to the bass mindfuck, watch Humphrey Bogart. And in other news, the 20 and 30 somethings I work with at work, who's Humphrey Bogart?
I'm not a fan, but
I know, right?
That breaks my heart.
It's
I mean, even if you haven't seen movies with Humphrey Bogart, like, you figure in popular culture, you might know who he is.
I don't think so anymore.
Jesus.
It's long enough ago.
We're old,
it's like, well, it's like us going like with the silent movies, right? Can you name the stars of the silent movies? Maybe two?
A couple. I can name like a few, but not many.
I mean,
Rhubarb Valentino, Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, Chaplin.
Okay.
Women, that would be
Mary Pickford.
Mary Pickford.
But you know what? I only know about her because of the jokes on
Nelson
Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh yeah, Nelson Eddy, the singing cow, the singing Mountie.
There you go. Oh, that's right. There was all those.
I worked with one of his relatives.
Oh wow. I only know about those because they were referenced in other things, right? Mm. And I haven't. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
10 Little Indians from 1974. It's based on a book by Agatha Christie.
Yep.
Yep.
Oh, this movie's so bad.
Oh.
I wanted to throw things at the TV.
Ooh.
It was all the cliches. Yeah, that one isn't one for the ages. Anti-Mame from 1958, Rosalind Russell. It was based on a book that was adapted to a stage play that also starred Rosalind Russell, and she got to do it in the movie. Some aspects of this movie did not age really well. Like, there's some racial portrayals that had me cringing. On the other hand, there are other parts. Like, it was totally poking fun at, like, the stupid upper class. And there was the anti-Semitism going on. Like, they talked about segregation. They didn't mean black segregation. They meant Jewish segregation. And it took a direct run at that.
Oh,
like,
wow.
It definitely was like, this is wrong. I am going to, like, screw you over because of it. And so I found it was, like, a lot of fun because of that. And it was definitely about, like, living your life. And she was, I mean, in in some ways, total white entitlement. She's like this white wealthy woman who is living her life to the fullest and getting judged because of it. But anyway, the style of it I found a little bit slow. That was, I think, just, you know, the time the movie was made.
Yeah.
So overall, I found it a fun watch, but it's definitely something you have to be into older movies. I don't know that it's not like The Thin Man.
You know? It doesn't play like that entertaining.
And finally, I got to see Men in Black International.
Oh, yeah.
I liked it. The story was far from perfect. Even though it was a short movie, it was kind of a bit draggy. But I don't know. I just had so much fun watching it. And the actors in it, I think it would have been a total, like, pile of dog crap if it hadn't had such great
talent
in there. I mean, like, all of the names that aren't coming to me right away, but even the bit, I mean, especially the bit characters, I think, like Emma Thompson and from the Taken series.
Liam Neeson.
Small roles, but I know, right? But it was a small role, but I think if you hadn't had somebody that good, it would have really fallen down. And I enjoyed Hemsworth and Thompson doing their thing.
Yeah.
Played the little, anyway, it's not going to win any awards. I don't know that I'll ever see it again, but it was a fun watch.
Yeah.
And that's my movies.
Nice.
I have a few, not a lot, but a few, and you guys may have some thoughts on some of these. So I had the good opportunity to do, there's a cinema in New York called the Quad Cinema, and they did a retrospective of Giallo films, and this is their second retrospective, and they had, I think, 5 movies in total, and I was asked to review a couple of them, so I took the opportunity because I'm not particularly familiar with Giallo films outside of probably like 1 or 2 of the really big ones. So I thought, okay, well, I'll pick a couple of these and watch them. And randomly, I ended up with 2 movies from the same director, and I didn't know it when I picked them. So I watched The Possessed from 1965 with Peter Baldwin, who was an American that worked almost entirely in Italy. So I couldn't quite figure out, and I'm not versed enough in the history of Giallo to really know for sure, but it seemed to me like some of the language in both of these movies was maybe dubbed. Like, I think some of the actors may have been speaking in English that was then dubbed into Italian while others were speaking in Italian, but it could just be me or maybe just the transfer. I don't know. It just, a lot of the times the things didn't kind of jive together, the mouth moving and the words coming out. So I don't know. But so both of directed by Luigi Bozzoni. The Possessed is from 1965, so it's at the early entries to the Giallo family, and it's in black and white, and it's really interesting. It's about this famous author who has been going to this town to like in during the summer to like be inspired and write. And he meets a woman there. And so he goes in the off season to try to reconnect with this woman, and the woman has disappeared. And then it's the backstory of what happened to the woman, and he's trying to figure it out, and there might be a mystery, and nobody really wants to talk about it. It's really like beautiful and stark and black and white, and it's really, really good. It's very sort of mysterious and has like a ghost element. I really enjoyed it. It's quite nice. And then at the other end of the spectrum, he made another movie towards the end of the whole giallo phase in 1971 with a Franco Nero. The Italian playboy, like he's ridiculously good looking, even for a man who was like probably my grandfather. But it's called The Fifth Chord, and he plays a alcoholic reporter, crime beat reporter, who becomes involved in a series of murders, and like he thinks he's getting framed for the murders. And it's very, it has like all these other themes, and it takes place in a big city. And the cinematography, that was the thing that kind of impressed me. I'm like, this movie looks fucking amazing. Well, the cinematography is Vittorio Storaro, who then went on to do like The Last Emperor and Dick Tracy and Apocalypse Now. And it is clear that this guy is talented. I didn't even know who he was until I looked him up, and I was like, well, obviously you can see the fingerprints. And it's good. I mean, it's super kind of silly in places, but it just looks amazing. It looks really amazing, and it's worth seeing just for that. So those are my two sort of giallo entries.
What is giallo?
So they get the name from the paperbacks that they were based on. So there was a phase in Italian, they're kind of like cheesy mysteries.
Oh, so like Penny Dreadfuls.
Yeah, and they used to be printed in paperback and with yellow covers. Oh. And so you always knew that this was like a mystery. They always had like some very standard tropes. Like usually there was a woman.
True crime.
Yeah, there was a woman that was murdered. Sometimes she was involved. It's usually, they say that's kind of like a precursor to the slasher movies in France and America. But they get their name from, because they were adapted from these books that had these yellow covers.
Oh, cool.
And giallo is yellow in Italian. I had no idea. I found this out like preparing for this little retrospective. So it was super interesting. Really enjoyed both of them for very different reasons. I will link to them and then to all of the, there were like five or six movies in that collection. And we have, I did these for the Alliance of Women Film Journalists, and we have like a bunch of reviews. I'll link to them. It's totally worth reading some of the stuff because it's pretty interesting. Roadhouse was on TV. Full admission, I had never seen Roadhouse.
I haven't seen it yet either.
And Dan is like, how have you not seen Roadhouse? We need to watch this movie.
This
like,
is with Patrick Swayze, okay. Right?
Yeah, so it's Patrick Swayze. So, watching Roadhouse now, I have no idea what it was like when it came out. This is my thoughts watching Roadhouse as a like 40-year-old woman, like 30 years after it was released, or however long. Patrick Swayze was like, I think near the height of his hotness at the point that came out. Yep. So he plays a bouncer, a bouncer who wears like these amazing suits, practices like Tai Chi, meditates. So he's like a new age bouncer. I have like, it's the weirdest thing. And he lives in this barn with no electricity. It's just crazy, but it's super charming too, mostly because Patrick Swayze has amazing charisma. So he's basically hired, he's this hotshot bouncer. He's hired by this bar that's trying to like rebrand. There used to be like this Western bar, and now they're rebranding to something a little more classy. But there's a guy in town that's like the Magnum, and he wants to sort of take over, and there's all this clashing, and it's super cheesy and ridiculous. But really, really fun. And Patrick Swayze meets a girl who happens to be a doctor and is like supermodel hot. It's Roadhouse. I don't know. I don't understand why this movie is like so lauded and like quoted and stuff, because I watched it and I was like, okay, it was Patrick Swayze being hot. Sure. I thought for sure you guys had seen this.
So I have seen it. It's not that memorable. I can add to it.
No, it's not that memorable. I just thought it was hilarious.
But yeah, people...
I can speculate, but it's just that. It's speculation.
It's one of those things that it seems like when I hear people talking about Patrick Swayze, it's either women who are in love with him from Dirty Dancing or Ghost. Ghost. Or
both great.
It's guys who like, he's fucking kick ass and it's from Roadhouse.
Yeah, which I don't get. I don't get. There was basically almost no fighting in that movie, so I have no idea.
Exactly.
But that happened. So Dan was on holidays for 2 weeks, and Melissa and I had made plans to go and see Midsommar because we now have a tradition. We go and see Ari Aster horror movies together because we're, you know, sadistic. And I said to Dan, we're going to the movies. You should come. It's like a horror movie. It'll be lots of fun. And Dan came. And oh God, it's so weird. So the basic story is this young woman and her boyfriend, they're kind of on the rocks. They go on this trip to Europe to one of the guys that they go to school with comes from, I want to say they're in Switzerland, but I honestly can't remember, somewhere in like Scandinavia. And he comes from a small town that maybe there's like a cult element, and he decides to take his friends there while they get there, and shit goes like fucking insane and people die and there's these amazing moments of murder and it's great and weird and long and weird. It's just weird.
I like 90-year cult cycles.
It's basically what it is. Yeah. Every few years, oh, like something right, happens.
That one. I remember that the trailer one. Now.
It's really unsettling in places because he really plays with, like, for me, when I think of using, like, effects in dramas and horror movie, this is what I want. Like, yeah. He uses practical effects to really get at the, like, the visceral moments of horror. And then he uses CGI to kind of just, like, fuck with you. So you're sitting there watching a scene and you're like, that seems a little off. And the more you watch her, the more you realize that he is playing with shit on the screen in such a way that you're not really sure it's happening, but you think it's happening, and you're like, that's fucking genius.
Daylight horror.
It's great.
It's hard to pull off.
But when it works, it works. Yeah. It's not, I don't think it's as good as, I can't remember the name of this first movie. I don't think it's as good as the first one. It certainly has these amazing moments. Florence Pugh is fucking genius, and so is Jack Rayner, but she kills it. Like, she has all the crazy breakdown moments, and she's fucking amazing in all of them. So that happened. Dan's like, I'm never coming to the movies with you again. I'm like, I warned you.
Was this Sweeney Todd?
Not that bad. He's like, he said to me in the car, at least it wasn't Sweeney Todd.
Did he really? I love
he's
that.
He's never going to give up on this one.
I love the fact that I was there for that.
Yes. We were randomly going through TV trying to find something to watch, and we ended up on The Hummingbird Project, which is Kim Nguyen's movie from last year. I think it opened VIFF. It's a Canadian film with Jesse Eisenberg and Alexander Skarsgård and Salma Hayek, and they decide they're going to build a direct line from like some data center to their trading office to have like 0.5 millisecond above everybody else on trading so they can make all this extra
skim
money.
Skim the money because they get the trade a split much. Second before everyone else.
Yeah, but the line has to be as direct as possible, and they have to go through all of these like bizarre places and buy all this land, and it's this giant project. And Salma Hayek's like, well, what the fuck are they doing? They used to be like former employees. The whole thing is kind of convoluted, but really fun. The performances are actually pretty great. And the movie itself is pretty slight, but really interesting. And Skarsgård is really, really good. And he's like, I don't know if he's wearing like a partial bald cap. He looks completely different than usual. It works. It's fun.
Which Skarsgård was this again?
This is the Alexander Skarsgård.
That's the True Blood Skarsgård. Yeah.
The True Blood one. I Love You Now Die. So this is legit the name of this documentary. I Love You Now Die. Now it does have like a subheader that I cannot remember, but this screened on HBO as a two-part. I think it's like, I want to say it's 2.5 hours long approximately. It's not like each part was like 3 hours or something. This is really interesting. So it's directed by Aaron Lee Carr. It's a documentary about Michelle Carter, who was a teenager that was charged with manslaughter for the death of her boyfriend, who she basically only knew from text messaging. They only met like 4 times in real life. He committed suicide. They committed suicide and they were convinced that she was responsible. Now, it kind of starts as that and then turns into this completely different thing. And it's one of these documentaries that probably does the best job I've ever seen of being like balanced. Like, it starts as one thing and you think you know the story and you think, okay, this woman was a monster. And then you get the second half of the story and you're like, okay, so they were both two kids that were like in a lot of trouble and technology killed them. Is essentially what it comes down to. It's genius. I highly recommend everybody see it. It's amazing. And if this doesn't scare you about not keeping track of what your kids are doing online, then you're beyond help, is essentially what it comes down to. Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror, another story here. I kept seeing trailers for this thing on YouTube, like autoplay ads. And I'm like, okay, where is this movie playing? It's playing on Shudder. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll try Shudder. Well, I've already, at some point, I tried the 7-day free trial of Shudder, but I tried it again and I liked it so much, I'm like, I'm just going to subscribe. So I now have a subscription to Shudder. So I've been watching a lot of stuff. This was the first thing I watched. It's a documentary about African-Americans in horror, and it's really good. It basically traces back the turn of the century and how, what is the name of the movie? My mind's gone blank. But it's a really good documentary. It's really, really interesting. What I'm getting at is Shudder has lots of really great stuff. Highly recommended it if you're a horror fan. It's worth the $5 a month that it costs. I'm really, really loving it. It's pretty great. I watched For Sama, which is a heartbreaking documentary. It's directed by Wad Al-Khatib. She is a journalist who was in, I can't remember the name of the city now. The city that was completely destroyed during the last war.
Like World War II?
No.
In Libya?
In Libya. What is the name?
Oh, yeah. I can't remember the...
I can't remember now. But so she was a young journalism student when the war began. She decided to stay. She got married, had a child in the middle of this war. And she went, I guess she'd always been doing like sort of video journalism. And then she decided that she was going to do like a video diary for her daughter when she had a child. And it was kind of trying to explain to her why she stayed. It's like nothing I've ever seen before, because it just touches on so many things. Not only are you seeing war from this perspective of a woman that is kind of caught in the middle of it, but she's also trying to explain why people stay in a war zone. Like, why would you opt to keep your child, your baby, and stay when at any point you could die? Like, they're just bombing every day.
This was Syria, right?
Yeah, in Syria. It's insane. The documentary is sort of cobbled together from all this video footage that she was collecting over the years that basically she wasn't like there. And then before they escaped, it's heartbreaking. It's really worth watching though. It's really, really good, but really hard to watch at times. Super, super interesting. And then I watched yesterday the Danny Boyle movie, which I mentioned at the end of the last episode. I had thoughts. It's really forgettable.
Okay. Yeah. But was it fun in the moment?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, well.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
I mean, it looks really great. I mean, Danny Boyle can't really make a really shitty film at this point. It doesn't suffer from, like, I don't think it suffers from the terrible endings that Danny Boyle movies tend to suffer from. It's just very kind of blah. I don't know. I mean, it's fun enough when you're watching it and the romance is really sweet and the music is really great. And oh, what's her name? McKinnon is amazing.
Kate
McKinnon plays, she has the side role as...
Right, agent or something.
Well, because Ed Sheeran is in it as like himself. And she plays his manager who then manages the guy. The basic premise for those that don't know is there's like this cataclysmic event that happens and this one guy wakes up and he's the only one that remembers the Beatles. Yeah.
Probably, alternate timeline. Yeah, somehow the Beatles didn't exist.
Exactly. And the running gag is
But he remembers them.
Yeah, he remembers them. And the running gag is that there are other random things that you start to discover are also missing from the timeline. And some of them are fucking hilarious. Like at one point he's like, all I want to do is have a cigarette. And they're like, what's a cigarette? And you're like, wow, okay, that's weird. Cancer rates
just plummet.
Yeah, it's just, so there's little tidbits that are super sweet, and it's sweet in the moment, but it's just very, it's whatever.
All right.
It's fine. And then last night, Dan and I watched The Great Hack, which just dropped on Netflix, when we're recording this, like a couple of days ago. So it's it starts off as a pretty mediocre documentary about Cambridge Analytica. And then turns really, really interesting. So it's this particular part of the story follows Professor David Carroll, who's an American professor of like data and marketing and whatever else. And when he finds out, the whole thing starts coming out about Cambridge Analytica and data points, whatever else, he decides that he wants to get back his data. So he has to go to the UK to file a motion to basically sue Cambridge Analytica to get his data. And that's kind of how the story starts. And then it goes into the whole thing with what exactly did Cambridge Analytica do? What is their process? And then they introduce a character that Dan and I were kind of like, how come we've never heard of this woman? Her name is Brittany Kaiser. She was like one of the senior VPs at Cambridge who has since come out to speak against them. And you kind of, like, we were meeting her for the first time, but she's been... like everybody's interviewed her. She's done interviews with everybody and talks with everyone, but I'd never heard of her. And it's kind of a really interesting thing because along the way you meet all of these other people that are also trying to get to the bottom of what exactly was going on. One of the things they talk about is the Leave the EU campaign that basically Brexit that Cambridge Analytica maybe did or didn't have something to do with. It's interesting. It's not like it starts off really kind of silly because the graphics are and the voiceovers but once the documentary gets going, it's really interesting. I think it's worth checking out. And it's on Netflix, so you can watch it at any time. And that's it.
Nice. Books?
Books.
I'm done. For the millionth time rereading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy because I couldn't find any new... Lear Child books, no Pendergast, no Gideon, so...
Have you reached the bottom of that barrel?
I think I have, and I just... I was reading for a while Stephen Brust's version of like a book bibliophile / secret agent / treasure hunter, but like they got a little bit too rah-rah siskoomba somehow for me, so... So I went back to Hitchhikers, which is my go-to book, and every time I read it, I... rediscover just how depressing it is, and it is truly one of the most depressing books I've ever read, but it's funny and it's awesome. And this time, for some reason, I really got stuck on the character Zarniwoop and how he was abandoned by Zaphoid and Trillian kind thing and the crew kind thing on the planet which has the guy who actually is running the universe. And they stole his ship and left him there, and the guy who's running the universe had shut the door after Zarniwoop ran outside. And then he just thought the noises of someone pounding on the door was part of his imagination because this guy isn't fully completely all there. So, again, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. No matter how many times I read it, it depresses me. And the other one is I started rereading the book The Manufacture of Armor and Helmets in 16th Century Japan. This has been out of print for a very long time, and if you want one, I don't know if there's any interlibrary loan in Canada that has this book. Otherwise, prepare yourself to buy it for couple hundred bucks, probably. 150, wow. 200 bucks. So it's pretty good. Ignore the pictures and just read the writing. The pictures are pretty shitty. The drawings.
That sounds like a very niche margin.
Yes, yes. So, but I highly recommend it if you're interested in the manufacturing process of armor and helmets from 16th century Japan, the Warring States. And the final one is a tiny little book. It's called Weird Monuments of Canada, where they go through a few items, and I mean few. There's not many. Like, there are probably no more than 20 in this entire book, and it kind of offends me how much it gloss over everything, because I have a cork board right over there with, like, about 150 places just in BC with weird-ass shit. So, because I always wanted to make myself either a webpage or a book or something on the weird shit in BC.
This sounds like a road trip.
I would help with that.
Can I take part in it? I'm not even joking. Can I take part in the research road trip?
I have binders of stuff. Some of the stuff is no longer around. Like, I think the world's biggest rosary that was in Machosen, it's gone, and the world's biggest tin soldiers in New West, and the world's biggest cross-country skis, 100 Mile, and just weird-ass random things. The yellow submarines up in the, I want to say near the Alaskan Highway. You're starting to get near Yukon territory kind of thing. On the highway there, someone's gotten great big sort of propane tanks and then painted them up in bright yellow and sort of made them look like submarines. It's like going, what is going on? Like, all these weird ass things.
Somebody's beetle obsessed, apparently.
That's right. Weird's world's biggest fly reel in Houston, BC. Fly reel, not rod. I believe the rod is, there's a bigger one somewhere else. But the reel itself is the world's biggest.
So, okay. Yeah. See?
I love this shit.
This road trip.
Biting my tongue.
World's biggest push reel lawnmower is in, what is it, Grinrod, just near Vernon. I love it.
Don't give away all the secrets.
I know. Oh, there's hundreds and hundreds just in BC. So
this book missed the point.
Yeah.
It missed the mark. Colleen's going to print the one that we
really
want.
It's not just the world's biggest decorated Easter egg in Manitoba or something.
99% Invisible did an article on the world's biggest ball of twine.
Yeah. How many are there? There's like...
Well, this was the interesting thing about the article is there's like three, but they all have slightly different criteria and they're all kind of happy with that. One is the world's biggest natural ball of twine. I forget what the name is for the actual, but it's the organic one and it was done by a single person.
Oh, yeah.
The other one was done with the nylon style twine and it was an effort by a town. And I forget what the third one was.
Three different entries into the world's biggest hockey stick. Like we know the one in Duncan, BC, that was from Expo 86. And by almost every conceivable metric you use, that is the world's largest hockey stick. But there's two places down in the States that argue the point because, I don't know, like, it's laminated. It's like, it's still made out of wood. Like, you know, like, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. World's oldest telephone booth was, I believe, in Boswell, BC. It's like 480 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. Predated the telephone by like 300 years.
Never. I found out on Canada Land. Guess where the first oil well in Canada was?
Ontario.
Yeah, just outside of Toronto.
Yeah.
No idea.
Who knew?
Who knew?
Colleen did. Just saying.
Well, why wouldn't it? Like, it makes sense, like, because the vast populations in Ontario, the first cars were probably Ontario. So, like, the first person going, we should have a local source of this, probably beyond Ontario.
Makes sense.
Well, the fact that there was oil there to begin with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Is the interesting part to me.
Yeah.
Yep. So, those are my three books.
I have none.
I actually finished a couple books.
Woo!
and I just, I'm going
to... I shouldn't be surprised. I mean, Dale does read.
I do, not so much lately, but I want to give a big shout out to the Vancouver Public Library system. Like,
woohoo!
This whole system they have with, like, putting stuff on hold and having it come up, and it's kind of fun. It's kind of like a lottery. It's like, woohoo, one of my books came up.
Yep.
And when I hear about an interesting book now, because I'm cheap, don't want to buy the book. I just put it on my hold list, and yep. it's like it's,
eventually it'll come around.
It's wonderful. It's really wonderful.
Have you tried e-reading through the library? Because no, they do have that too.
I was actually checking that out, but I actually have more than enough to read. And I actually, the other thing about the library books is they put this deadline.
Yes.
Unlike the one that you loaned me like about 10 months ago that's still sitting on my shelf.
That's fine.
Anyway. We'll go with this because reasons, because you don't want to listen to me babble on about my move and shit. But I, after seeing a couple episodes of the Marie Kondo thing on Netflix, I got curious. And also because I have heard so many people talk shit about her, I was like, kind of curious now. So
does it spark joy?
I read her two books. Reading the books sparked joy. It did. The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up is her first book. Spark Joy,
it's
oddly enough, is she did a second book.
I didn't.
They're both really, really fast reads. And she's easy to make fun of, but her books kind of resonated with me, like because I'm in the situation of wanting to do a bunch of cleanup. And I was just looking for tips. I thought this was going to be a book on cleanup tips, like do this shit and it'll be easier to store. What I discovered, like a good movie almost, was a complete change up. Her whole thing in reality is really about this is how you can improve your life by just surrounding yourself with things that you actually enjoy. Like mm-hmm. her cleaning up thing is like, if you have shit in your life and it doesn't thrill you, why do you have it in your life? Like it's taking up space. Get rid of it. Get stuff in your life that you actually enjoy. And mm-hmm. her thing about things that give you joy, it's like it's whatever gives you joy, not what gives someone else joy.
She also said you shouldn't have more than like 20 books in your life.
No. That was never said in the books.
It wasn't?
And in fact, in the books, she has examples of people that like, I really like this thing, even though I am like never like say clothes. She gives a couple examples of t-shirts. I will never wear them in public. And she's like, if it really gives you joy, like keep them. Wear it inside.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like, but
yeah, all I know is from memes kind of thing. And just looking at the one meme, I started twitching. You should have no more than 20 books. I'm going to set you on fire, lady.
She is easy to make fun of. And I think the book suffers some in the translation. It was originally written in Japanese. And I know roughly, I don't know specifically, I'm actually curious now, but I know in Shinto and Buddhism, they have that very kind of thought of things have spirit and things have life. Mm. And you know, you see that in the media yokai. That I've watched. Yeah, and she, in the book, talks a lot about the energy of an object. And I think it's from that, like in a Japanese cultural sense, that would not mm-hmm. make anybody blink an eye, but in a North American context, I mean, some of the stuff came off sounding a little woo to me.
I have a book on yokai, Japanese like mythology and folktale and things like that. And anything that has basically been in a family for more than 100 years almost inevitably somehow becomes somehow possessed or something. Mm-hmm. No, it's not the right word, but like it becomes imbibed with an actual spirit. Like spirit.
Yeah. In one line in I think it was the second book, she says I forget the orientation, whether it was like Shinto or just culturally, but there's like four kinds of energies. There's the energy of the original material that you use. There's the energy of the person that made it. And I know in the making of like some things like samurai swords and stuff, like that's a really big deal. The artisan puts their energy in it and then the energy of the person that uses it.
Mm-hmm.
And I map that a little bit different in my brain. Like to me, it was like the respect you give an object. I definitely know if I respect an object more, I treat it better. Mm-hmm. It's going to last longer. I appreciate it more. I kind of mapped it to that. But I mean, it's like basically what I read in the book was a whole lot of this is a personal thing. Decide for yourself. Some of the passages were a little bit condescending. She clearly had an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also lots of examples of this is your personal thing. Figure it out.
It's one of the reasons why we have so many examples of very old Japanese swords or armor, things like that, because these were generally owned by the higher up. So it was a better made, like some of the best craftsmanship. But no one got buried with this stuff. No one got burnt with this stuff. And when the owner was done with it, because they have passed on for whatever reason, it was usually given to a temple, and then they stored it at, because it was a receptacle of some great leader kind of thing. And so we have examples of like armor and helmets where we can tell not only who made it, who inherited it, who wore it, and what battles they wore. Like, all this stuff is documented in Japanese temples. It's like, it's freaking awesome.
She doesn't...
It sparks joy.
She doesn't recommend, yeah. It's, well, I don't know. She
well, talks get rid of your life and give it to a temple.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. No, like I said, to me, what I discovered in her books was a lot about surround yourself with things that actually improve your life.
Mm-hmm.
Don't keep them just because you think you should.
Yeah.
Like, her stuff is all about a gut check to like, is this legitimately doing it or not? So,
yeah.
I really like the books.
Yep.
Then that's all I read.
I didn't read anything. So,
meanwhile, I've become basically a walking museum for my family's archives.
But see, this is the thing. Like, one of the things that I think is really fascinating is I did, like, we moved so many times over a period. I think I've talked about this before. At some point, I'm like, why am I moving these things that I don't, like, to me, they're just trinkets, right? But they don't have any, like, personal value. Like, I don't look at it and think that sparks any sort of emotion or idea or thought. It's just something I picked up because at the time, I thought it looked cute. Is that really a reason to keep it? No, it's just one more piece of thing I need to clean.
Mine is my great-grandfather built this, so I'm not going to deposit it anywhere.
So this is the thing. Like, yeah. But then I have other things that most people would look at and think, well, that's just a trinket. But to me, that has some sort of intrinsic value. Like,
yeah.
I have this piece of like rock. It's literally a piece of rock that came from the mine my grandfather worked on. I have this slate house that somebody in town made that looks like the houses from the small town I came from. Like,
meanwhile,
to me, it has value. To Dan looks at it and he's like, why do you keep that?
If I wasn't so lazy, I'd sell my Mondo tea posters. We were talking about this earlier. I'm just lazy.
And to me, like those have value to me in a different way than monetary.
Yeah.
Though I did look at the price and I'm like, well, you know, that would be a new pair of shoes.
Yeah. That's my vacation right there.
Almost.
I also wanted to say, whoever did the Netflix series completely missed the point.
Oh.
I mean, I originally got interested or reminded of her because of them, so I guess there's that.
But
the way they tried to reality TV it to make it interesting...
Doesn't
get totally to the lost theme. The point that I got in the books. Yeah. Like, totally lost
That's
the point.
That's fascinating.
Cool.
Any podcasts? Any podcasts?
I have one. It's called Noble Blood, and it's about nobility throughout the world that almost always ends up in murder or being murdered.
I like the sound of this.
It's interesting. It feels like a gap when I have a day where I get to listen to like 11 hours of podcasts in a day. Okay. So it's
works,
good.
Works for
it just started, so there's only a few episodes, but so far, so good. And that's it for podcast for me.
I'm going to mention one. It's Law Bites by Michael Geist. Michael Geist is a prof at the University of Toronto and kind of a thought leader, expert on Canadian copyright.
Oh.
He's often quoted and interviewed. His name crops up all over the place. The topics of his podcast are always interesting, but sometimes it's so dry.
Oh.
I've been cherry picking them. There's just no way I can, like, some of them I'm oh god. Yeah, enough said. If you're interested in like copyright and the kind of the issues around that, privacy issues and stuff, this guy is a really smart guy and he's really up on his policy. And he talks about telecom policy and rates and things.
Oh, cool.
Sometimes they are really interesting because the material's really interesting.
Yeah.
I can't give it a blanket recommendation because some of them are drying paint. But I think, you know, even, you know, if you're the one that painted the wall and wanted to come out perfect, drying paint is interesting. So, yeah. Like I said, I think it's a good one if you're interested in to cherry pick. But you're a stronger person than I, or a more interested person than I, if you can listen to each and every one.
I'm kind of the same with pretty much all of the podcasts I, well, not all. Some of them I listen to every episode and some of them I kind of jump around. One of the ones I jump around about all the time is Mark Maron's podcast.
Oh, yeah.
So I just want to mention,
exactly,
he recently did, and I don't know how recent, it might actually be old because I've been kind of hoarding a couple of the episodes that he had because they're usually pretty long. So I try to wait until I have some time to listen. He did an interview with David Lee Roth not that long ago, which I sent to Dan. Because it's fascinating. So David Lee Roth, better known as the lead singer of Van Halen at one point.
Just a gigolo.
Yeah, that was in my brain too.
Yeah, and then like later, just a gigolo. But wow, I was impressed. Very, very, very impressed. He is a very, very, like, you expect somebody that is that, has managed to, like, stay in the business for that long, has to have some sort of chops, like, you can't be a total idiot, but he is, yeah, he's very, very smart.
I really liked Mark Maron's part, like, what the fuck, when I was listening to it, but it was, like you say, it's longish, and I was really... His opening stuff, like he does all that opening.
I skip.
Yeah, that's what I should probably do.
That's what I do. I literally skip. I kind of listen to it because sometimes it's interesting,
but usually not.
No, I maybe give it like a minute. If it's I'm not thinking, I skip right to the interview and I just listen to the interviews.
I would really love for them to do a cut of just the interviews.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy enough to just skip ahead to the interviews. It's
the one he did with Obama. It's amazing.
Oh, and the thing is, he's a really great interviewer.
Amazingly enough, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he gets around to like a lot of stuff that you would never expect. And David Lee Roth essentially says, you know, I've talked about stuff that I generally don't talk about because he was like comfortable with the direction. And they talked for like an hour, a good solid hour. And it was really fascinating. Like, I said to Dan, you need to listen to this. It's great. I have newfound respect for David Lee Roth. Who knew?
That's something.
The
man, my memory of David Lee Roth was a quote, probably 25 years ago when they came to Vancouver to do an album. It's like, I like staying in Vancouver because the strippers take all their clothes off.
Well, so this is the thing. So David Lee Roth starts talking and he's like, you know, he has this way of talking that's both at times eloquent and other times just kind of like gutter talk. And he's talking about something really interesting and really deep. And then he'll throw in some quip about, you know, some chick or some booze or, you know, hooking up with some girls. And you're like, okay, so this is the same guy. Yep. Just go with it. It's just kind of interesting.
Fun.
That's the only thing I've got. Nothing else.
Coolio.
Yep.
That was July.
That was July. Come on by atcpod.ca. We'll link to all of the good things we talked about this month or this week or this episode.
This media spew.
Yeah, sorry.
The spew list. The list of the spew.
And we will be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. So until next time.
There's one other thing I want to mention.
Oh, go
quick.
For it.
Rest in peace, Rutger Hauer.
Yeah, I know. I actually had missed the news, and then I saw a couple of things come up on Rutger Hauer. I'm like, I said to Dan, did Rutger Hauer die? Dan's like, yeah. I'm like, that's kind of sad.
I hope he sees sea beams on his way wherever the hell he's going.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. All I kept thinking about was Hobo with a shotgun.
I was reading about, obviously Blade Runner was the big one they were talking about, and then I'm like, yeah, this is the guy that did what he did with Blade Runner, which was amazing. But equally, I mean, his performance in Hobo with a Shotgun, I just
tour de
blows me away. And just how much better he was than everybody else.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, he's pretty good. Pretty good. Rest in peace.
Yeah. Hobos, if they're not solving crimes, they're committing them.
You got to.
Yeah. I'm going to put that on a shirt.
Why not? Dan's been talking about getting a cricket because the new crickets can print on fabric.
Are they still proprietary locked to everything?
Don't know.
Okay, because that's why I went with Silhouette, because I
have
could...
no idea. You and Dan can have this discussion because right. he's been driving me bananas every time I go to Costco. Yeah. Do they still have the crickets? I'm like, yep, they still have
if
the crickets.
If it's priority locked, stay the hell away from that machine. But
you guys
otherwise...
can have this conversation. I just don't care. Couldn't be bothered. This is Dan's project. I...
So much fun.
Sure, whatever he makes, I will be happy, but I don't really care. So now are we done?
Yep.
Sure,
I promise.
Be sure to come on by atcpod.ca. Links to all of the things. And until next time,
we'll see you after the credits.
Just a small town girl living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere.
Just a city boy, born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going
along the line, my recorder stopped.